The Bulletin on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's March, and spring is springing, and everything is getting greener, and it's going to be really green by St. Patrick's Day. 22 years ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing Thomas Cahill. He came out to Yellow Springs for an interview. His first book in his Hinges of History series had just come out in paperback. It's called How the Irish Saved Civilization, the Untold Story of Ireland's Heroic Role, from the Fall of Rome to the Rise of Medieval Europe. And if I had to go back over the many interviews that I've done over the years, I would pick this one as one of my all-time favorites. Here's Thomas Cahill on the Best of the Book Nook. This book really amazed me. There was so much information here that I was not aware of. What's the basic premise?
It starts in the 5th century, which is an awful long time ago. And what happened in the 5th century was that the Western world virtually came to an end. And it came to an end very quickly. In less than 100 years, Western Europe became illiterate. And the reason this happened was that the barbarians came over the Rhine and the Danube, finally in such numbers that they overwhelmed the civilization that they were coming into, the Roman civilization. And they changed Western Europe forever they were illiterates, they were semi-nomadic, they settled down to farming, they really began what turned into the little kingdoms of early medieval Europe, and they completely destroyed the Roman Empire. The last Roman emperor fell toward the end of the century, and that was the end of that. But what was far more important was that in that period, people stopped reading and writing. You can't really read when you're running. And that's exactly the situation that people found themselves in. You'd have to imagine Antioch closing, all the universities of North America closing, gradually all the secondary schools and primary schools closing, finally nobody having books to pass on to one another, children and grandchildren becoming illiterate, and watching all of this happen within a generation or two as people worried about far more critical, far more life-threatening issues, such as whether they were going to survive the barbarians. And it was in this period, when it looked as if all should be lost, that the Irish, in effect, in the nick of time, came over the hill, like the cavalry in the old Westerns. They were the last people on earth who should have been able to save Western civilization. If you had asked an educated Roman of the day what he thought of the Irish, he would probably have laughed out loud. They were the fiercest and most bizarre of all the barbarian tribes. And the barbarian tribes were pretty fierce and pretty bizarre. The Irish practiced human sacrifice. They were the great slave traders of the day. They would stop on the coasts of Europe and pick up a few strapping young kids, as many as they could find from local farmsteads, and bring them back to slave auctions in Ireland. And that was how they made their own money, as it were. And the other thing that they did was they loved to war on one another. They were really a bunch of cattle raiders and nothing more. All these little kings of Ireland would go out in an afternoon and raid one another's cattle. They did not hold their own life highly. In fact, the saying of the time it was a short life and eternal fame. In other words, the best thing possible was to die as bloodily as possible on the battlefield, and thus secure for yourself eternal fame by a ballad being written about you and your story being passed on from one generation to another. This is what the Irish were like. So when you think about that, you say, well, now, how on earth did this happen? And it's nothing short of miraculous that the literature of Western civilization, the content of Western civilization, was saved at all. But that it should be saved by the Irish defies belief. And yet this is what happened.
You draw a lot of compelling portraits in this book. A key figure is Patricius, who is better known as St. Patrick. He's a key figure.
Well, Patrick is the hinge. Without Patrick, none of this would happen. He's the real hinge of this whole historical period. He is, I think, one of the truly great figures of Western history, and he's almost completely unknown. I mean, we know him for things that he actually didn't do. You know, he did not chase the snakes out of Ireland. Sorry about that, but there never were any there. We have no way of knowing whether he used the Trinity to used the shamrock to explain the Trinity to the Irish. That's another legend. Could possibly be true, but he wasn't, in fact, even born in Ireland. Much to the eternal shame of the Irish, he was born on, believe it or not, the island of Britain. Now, he was not an Englishman. We could say this because there were no Englishmen in that period in the 5th century. The people who would become the English were the Angles and Saxons of continental Europe who were harrying the east coast of Britain but didn't settle there for another century. And the Irish were harrying the west coast of Britain. And the Roman legions had, departed early in the 5th century. But up till that point, Britain was a Roman province. And Patrick was a Roman teenager, rather brash, brought up to think well of himself, an entitled young man. And his family probably spoke Latin at home. They might have spoken an early form of Welsh to the servants. And at the age of 16, one morning early, he was stolen by one of these Irish raiding parties. He was kidnapped and hauled off to Ireland and sold as a slave. And for the next 6 years, he was a shepherd's slave on the hills of Antrim, which was a terrible, terrible existence. He had been plucked out of civilization and pushed into this culture, could hardly be called a civilization, of truly mad human beings by his standards. It was a time of great terror. He didn't know the language. He didn't know the customs. He didn't know what was going on. He tells us that the whole time he had two constant companions, hunger and nakedness. They didn't feed him and they didn't clothe him. And if you've ever visited Ireland, you know that you very much need clothes there. It's rather damp. So he must have been a very well-fed and beloved child to have survived those 6 years. And the way he talks about it, it's almost reminiscent of the way many modern hostages have gotten through their ordeal in places like Iran. He tells us that he always thought religion was silly and he didn't really believe in God and he thought priests were foolish and all of that. But in this situation, he really had no one to turn to, and he began to pray. And this prayer life of Patrick, or Patricius, as he would then have been known, really gathers steam over that six-year period. He really becomes a truly spiritual person. And at the age of 22, which is the age he was when he finally escaped, he has gone in this period from 16 to 22 is, of course, a period of great transformation for any human being. It's the period in which you're sort of psychologically formed into the man or woman you're going to be. And the man, Patrick, at 22, was a completely different person from the boy, Patricius, at 16. He really had gone from being this carefree, entitled Roman teenager to being a holy man, somebody to whom God spoke directly. In fact, the last night of his captivity, he heard a voice, and the voice said to him, "Your sufferings are at an end. Your hungers are rewarded. You're going home." And Patrick sat up in bed and looked around for the source of the voice and realized it was inside of himself. And then the voice continued and said, "Look, your ship is ready." And prompted by this voice, Patrick walked 200 miles to an inlet, we think in the neighborhood of Wexford. He was nowhere near the sea. He had to go 200 miles. Well, it was just as hard in that period for a slave to walk 200 miles without being intercepted as it would have been in 19th century America in the South. And during this period, I think this is the moment at which Patrick comes to realize he is actually under God's protection. And by the time he gets to the sea and sees the boat and jumps on and leaves, he has this feeling that he is surrounded by a loving God. And it really takes him largely through the rest of his life, that experience. It takes him years and years to return to Ireland, and it's obvious that he didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
He never really became an educated man because he had missed out on that period of 16 to 22, which is a pretty crucial period. So that his Latin, which he writes in old age, is a kind of semi-literate Latin. I mean, it's all right. You can get through it. But it has none of the style that we're accustomed to. He's the only sort of ordinary man ever to have written Latin up to that point. All the others wrote with great style and flash. Patrick has none of that. You know, he just about gets from the beginning of the sentence to the end of the sentence, and you can see that it kind of hurts to do it. And this is the man who, after many years, came back to the Irish and brought with him the gospel. And that's the moment of crucial difference, because the Irish took to what he had to say, and they took to it very quickly, which is also remarkable. And it's a great testimony to Patrick himself. Patrick was a man of immense courage, just in returning to the Irish. And, you know, no one, this is the 5th century, and we think, of course, of Christianity as still in its infancy, but it was 5 centuries old. 5 centuries is a long time. No one in 5 centuries had ever gone beyond the Roman Empire. No one had ever preached to the barbarians. No one wanted to know about the barbarians. They were simply unthinkable. Patrick is the first person to do this. So he takes this immense step. And in taking it, he has to figure out, how is he going to preach to barbarians? They don't read and write. They don't know anything of the customs of the empire. They ain't got no manners. You know, they're really a dreadful bunch, running around with paint on their faces and whooping it up. You know, how could anybody talk to them?
You are listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. I'm Vic McInnes. You're listening to the best of the Book Nook. We're going back to 1996 for an interview I did right at this time of year. St. Patrick's Day was coming up. And the paperback of How the Irish Saved Civilization had just come out, and I was joined in studio by Thomas Cahill. The book went on to become a huge bestseller. It dominated the bestseller nonfiction list for a couple of years. We'll bring you the rest of that interview right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, my 1996 interview with Thomas Cahill, about how the Irish saved civilization. And a central figure in the story is St. Patrick of Ireland.
I think the reason that Patrick succeeded was that he was in himself such an impressive person. The Irish were really impressed that he wasn't afraid of them. he was the first person they had ever encountered who wasn't. And he didn't have a sword. He didn't have anything with him. He didn't have anything but his gospel book. And gradually, as they saw that he meant to stay there, that he was committed to them, it made an immense impression on them. And Ireland is the first country to receive Christianity without bloodshed. And though this was, in fact, a notable thing to have happened, it bothered the Irish terribly. Once they began to read and write, and Patrick realized that he didn't have to teach them all the customs of Rome, but he did have to teach them to read and write. The way he did it was he used these simple little stories that were called martyrologies, which were the stories of the early martyrs, all the people who had been eaten by lions and who had had their heads chopped off and all that, you know, and their flesh flayed and the people who were roasted on spits and all that kind of stuff. Well, they loved this stuff. They just adored it, you know. It was right up their alley. And they were so mad that they didn't have any martyrs, you know. They wanted some martyrs too. And so they invented something that they called the green martyrdom. The red martyrdom was the martyrdom by blood, and they couldn't have that because by this point, and very quickly, all of Ireland accepted Christianity. Before telling you about that, I would just mention that that Patrick, and this is, I think, why we should consider him one of the great sort of founders of the Western world. He's the first person in all of human history to condemn slavery as unequivocally immoral. I mean, remember, Peter and Paul both told slaves to obey their masters, and that was just the general thought. Nobody had ever had another thought. And Patrick, who had had the experience of being a slave and yet was basically a literate man and could speak literately to other literate people, believed that slavery was immoral, and he says it again and again in his own writings. He strikes out against it most vociferously. Besides his autobiography, we have a letter to British Princeling, who had been rounding up Patrick's own converts as slaves, a letter to the Prince Caroticus, and it's a howl of outrage against the very idea of slavery. It really is a kind of letter from a Birmingham jail written in the 5th century. No one condemns slavery again until the Anabaptists in the 17th century. And it takes two more centuries. It takes till well into the 9th century before the idea that slavery is really a horrible, disgusting institution becomes general. So Patrick really is a man born out of time, not only in being the first missionary, the first true missionary, and not only in actually figuring out how to soften this intensely hard culture and make it more humane, but also in his attitude towards slavery, which is simply unique in all of this history. He's also really the first optimist in history. He, unlike the other church fathers who talked forever and ever about sin and its consequences, Patrick doesn't have any of that. Patrick has an extremely energetic, bouncy form of Christianity. And I think that was another way that he melded himself to the Irish. The Irish did think of the world as magical, and he built on that. And he took away the fear that was underneath some of that. Some of the Irish gods were not particularly people that you'd want to meet on a dark night. They were kind of terrifying. He got rid of all of that, but he kept the mystical aspect. And he kept a sense of fun that is hard to find in continental Christianity of the same period. Very hard to find. And this sense of fun and enjoyment in life and the universe and nature flows right into early Irish literature. In fact, Irish literature is the first vernacular literature of Europe to be written down. After the failure of the Green Martyrdom, the Irish found... I just got to that. I didn't mention the... the Green Martyrdom was an attempt... to go off into the desert the way the monks of the desert had done, and to live alone as a hermit. And it was called the Green Martyrdom because he went off into a green no man's land somewhere, because the Irish didn't have anything remotely like an Egyptian desert. And the problem was, once you got into this green no man's land, you didn't have any trouble eating. You know, you didn't have to eat. There was food was plentiful. And then, because of the insatiable Irish tendency to sociability, the hermit was soon joined by other hermits. And he could no longer be called a hermit. He was now the abbot of a monastery. And it was these little places that became the first recorders of history. And they really, they were great humanists. They opened their door to every kind of book that they could lay their hands on. And again, unlike the continental Christians who took a kind of dim view of the pagan classics of Greek and Rome, the Irish thought that these stories were just terrific. They loved them, and they wrote them down, and they rewrote them. And it was in this writing and rewriting that much of literature was saved, because at the time there were no printing presses. The only way that a book could be saved would be if someone would copy it. The only way you could have a library would be if you copied out somebody else's books. And if you were a literate person of that time, the books of your library would generally have been written out in your own hand, unless you were very wealthy and could employ a scribe. And it was these Irish scribes that then began to copy out all of literature.
I love the editorial comments that they would insert on the margins or at the ends, their opinion of the piece.
Yes,
or...
they didn't just copy. And I think they were simple people, and they did get a big kick out of the alphabet and just doing this, whereas a more sophisticated people might have found this kind of drone labor. They did not at all. They thought it was great fun. And they felt that a book should be not just one text, but that it should contain many texts that would talk to one another, as it were. So the scribe would try to put inside the covers of one book a little bit of everything he knew about, some natural history, some grammar, different languages, just about everything he could come up with. So you'll find in one of these codices, you'll find, you know, a sermon, then you'll find some, a little Homer, you know, and then all of a sudden the shape of the, a little discourse on the shape of the world, but all from other authors, ancient authors. But then the scribe would also feel that he had a right to speak back to the authors. And he would make comments, sometimes positive and sometimes negative, in the margins about what he was copying. There's a great marginal comment in one of these books where the scribe has been copying out the story in the Iliad of the death of Hector on the plain of Troy at the hands of Achilles. And he was really, this was really the great sad story of the ancient world. It was the saddest thing of all. And the scribe has written in the margin, "I can't tell you how upset this is making me." And there are so many things like that. And then sometimes they didn't comment on the action at all. Sometimes they were bored. And then they would do other things. They not only doodled, which was the beginning of the Irish design of these books. Books like the Book of Kells really began as a bunch of doodles to keep the mind of the scribe awake. But then they also began to put in the margins their own literature, which had previously only been oral. So and you'll find these funny things. They obviously weren't all monks, you know. Like one of them has in the margin a little quatrain, and it goes like this in English, but the Irish is very good as well. "All are keen to know who'll sleep with blonde Aideen. All Aideen herself will own is that she will not sleep alone." And you know, this is probably not, this young scholar is not headed for the monastic life. So there were many, many people doing the copying. They weren't all monks. And there were many women doing the copying as well. And one of the interesting things about this period and this form of Christianity was that it regarded women much more highly than they had been regarded on the continent. The abbesses of early Ireland, of early Christian Ireland, were in many, many, many instances more important than any bishop or abbot. And they held great power. In other words,
they had priestly duties.
Absolutely. Their hands could heal. They heard confessions. We think they may have said Mass. We're not sure. They certainly had bishops reporting to them, and they certainly appointed bishops. And that's about as much power as you could get in mm-hmm. early Christianity, the appointment of bishops. So they were pretty big stuff. And the biggest of all was, of course, the great co-patron of Ireland, Bridget of Kildare, who was High Abbess of Kildare and a great figure in her own right. Many wonderful stories about her, some of which I've retold in the book.
Another figure who was quite compelling was Columbkill.
Yes. Well, he's really the final link in the story. He is the first monk to leave Ireland and settle elsewhere. And he settled not far away by our standards. He settled in Scotland on the island of Iona. And he became the man who evangelized Scotland. He is the apostle of Scotland. But this step, since he was so much admired, he was himself an extremely fierce kind of monk and engaged in battles, which was one of the reasons why he had to leave Ireland. He was excommunicated for a while. And the only way he could get back into good graces was to allow himself permanent exile. So he became a permanent exile, and he was so much admired because he was such a fierce kind of Christian many, many people wanted to imitate him. And they developed what they called the White Martyrdom, which was finally a success. And the White Martyrdom was to sail off into the white sky of mourning, never to return, which was really the hardest thing an Irishman could think of doing. It was much harder than dying. Monks began to set off in all directions. Some of them, like Brendan the Navigator, even reached North America. Others set off in boats without oars, and we're not sure where some of them ended up because they wanted to put themselves completely in the hands of God. But most of them ended up in continental Europe, where they established little Irish monasteries among the Germanic heathens of Western Europe. And from those monasteries, they evangelized Western Europe and taught it once again to read and write. And they brought the ancient civilization back to its ancient home. And that is really how the Irish civilization.
Let's say this never happened. What would the world be like?
It would certainly be a very different place. We would probably be... our culture might very well be illiterate. If it were literate, we would have lost certainly all of Latin literature. I'm sure we would have lost the Aeneid and Ovid and Catullus and all of those people. We would have lost certainly some of Greek literature, probably not all of it, because there had always remained during this period a small Greek state on the Bosphorus, Constantinople. I don't think we would have lost the Bible. I think it would have been maintained by scattered communities of Jews. Certainly what we call the Old Testament, the New Testament would certainly have been kept at Constantinople. But we would be completely different. We might not be interested in any of those things. They might be antiquities of such a rare kind that no one would ever even seek them out. We would probably have a kind of Germanic Muslim culture that would be very, very different from anything that exists or anything that we have ever known. And it would have gone in who knows what directions, but those would have been the major influences. And whether we're better or worse, we certainly would be very, very different.
You draw so many incredible images in this book. They were all flashing through my mind repeatedly, and they just keep popping up, the image of the hordes waiting for the Rhine to freeze.
Yes.
That is quite an image.
Yeah. Well, that really happened. It was the last day. That was the greatest of all invasions over the Rhine. And it happened on the last day of December in the year 406. So it's early in the 5th century. Hundreds of thousands of Germanic warriors and their wives and children massing on the far side of the Rhine, while the Roman legions stood on their side and watched this happening. As it got colder and colder and colder, the Rhine finally froze solid enough to form a bridge for all these people to come across. And they came across in such waves that the legions couldn't stop them.
And that was the end of...
Well, it was the beginning of the end.
The beginning of the end.
Those people sort of went straight ahead until they hit the Pyrenees. And then they spread out sort of into Gaul and along the Pyrenees. And they caused enormous havoc in their wake. They burned and looted. And I mean, there really were hundreds of thousands of people. And in that period, a large city could be 100,000 people. Hundreds of thousands of people to us would be like millions to us. It would have the same kind of effect if they suddenly invaded. And they didn't even think of themselves as invaders. I mean, they were basically immigrants who were trying to get on the good side of the river. That's really what that was all about.
Sure.
They wanted what the Romans had.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, revisiting my 1996 interview with Thomas Cahill. And the barbarians were truly at the gate. We'll continue my conversation about how the Irish saved civilization right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and we are revisiting my 1996 interview with Thomas Cahill. I had a wonderful conversation with him 22 years ago. He came out to Yellow Springs, and we talked about this lovely book of his, which went on to become a huge bestseller. And then I was very surprised later in the evening after his event at a bookstore in Dayton to get a phone call from him saying, "I'd like to continue our conversation. How about if I come out to Yellow Springs and we can have dinner together?" I've never had this happen before or since. He came out and we had a lovely meal together at the Winds Cafe, drank a little wine, and kept talking about how the Irish saved civilization. Let's listen now to the final part of our interview. And Rome was sacked by so many different groups of invaders, including the Celtic people.
Well, much earlier they had been, but that was the last sack of Rome, of the city of Rome itself, until this period. Rome had been unmolested for nine centuries at that point. And Romans thought that Rome would last forever. They saw no reason to think otherwise. That's why Rome was called the Eternal City, because it was never going to fail. It was never going to fall before anything. And people actually believed that. They really believed that they were impregnable.
My guest is Thomas Cahill. His book, which just came out in paperback, is How the Irish Saved Civilization, The Untold Story of Ireland's Heroic Role from the Fall of Rome to the Rise of Medieval Europe. Another thing that you really make a clear differentiation about is the difference between Roman Christianity and the Christianity in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
The Romans did not accept their form of Christianity as being legitimate.
Well, to give an Irish answer to that, they did and they didn't. Patrick and Bridget became saints of the Western Church. So in that sense, it was accepted. But it really was a different kind of Christianity. It was a much more upbeat, much more positive, much more optimistic form of Christianity. Patrick really believed, unlike, say, his near contemporary, Augustine of Hippo, who came up with the theory of original sin and believed that we were all pretty bad, Patrick really believed that underneath it all we were pretty good, and that the worst of human beings could be transformed. He believed it from his own experience of life, that and also from his early converts that he made, these horrible warriors who had, you know, shrunken heads hanging from their belts, and who would have sliced your head off in a moment, finally bowed before the gospel and accepted a much more peaceful way of life and said, yeah, this is really a much better way of doing things than the way that we had. And they put down the knives of sacrifice and they stopped sacrificing children. And they stopped killing opponents. And they really became very quickly a very different people, so that he, in his effects, he was proven right. His optimism really turned out to be a much truer way of looking at the universe. He wasn't a fool. He knew perfectly well. He says even at the end of his life, I know that any day I could be murdered in this society, because there was still plenty of opportunities for that. And he's not afraid of it. He's come to live with that insecurity. But he had this fantastic sense of the presence of God, which had obviously come from this six-year period, this sort of novitiate that he had gone through as a shepherd slave. And that sense never seems to have left him, or he never seems to have doubted. So his courage comes from this immense confidence that he is surrounded by providence, and that he will succeed at what he is going to do. And these horrible people are going to turn good, mm-hmm. and that's all there is to it. And he really gave that sense to them, so that the first Christian poems in Ireland are very, very different from any of the literature that we know from the continent, which, as I said before, was so often about sin and gloom. And they are these wonderful little things in which you they're almost like the pictures, the little miniature pictures in the gospel books, where everything has its own color. Everything stands out as if it were lit by the sun and is perfectly three-dimensional and lovable. There's a great lovableness in all the things that are pictured. The world is lovable. The world is good. And it's an extraordinary literary springtime for the Irish. It enables them to dispel the darkness of the pagan night that they had gone through, and to live it up and to enjoy themselves immensely. And it's from that experience, that's the ingredient that is the difference between the ancient world and the medieval world. The medieval world still had plenty of doom and gloom about it. It still had many of the attitudes of the ancient world. But when we think about the Middle Ages, we think of it as far more sprightly than we think of the ancient world. The difference, the real difference is the Irish ingredient, which then became anonymous as the Middle Ages went on. But this sense of fun and of standing things on their head and having a good time, mockery at the prepossessing and self-important, all of that, which we think of when we think of the Middle Ages, or at least I do, I think others do, that really is injected into medieval civilization by the Irish. I said in the book that they are the hidden ingredient, the unnamed ingredient, the leaven which allowed the bread of Europe to rise and to escape the humorless confines of classical pessimism.
I love the anecdote from Sigmund Freud about the Irish.
Well, Freud did say that he thought the Irish were the only people on earth who could not be helped by psychoanalysis. And whether or not that's true, I wouldn't want to say. But there is a sort of, I believe, and I keep referring to this at different points of the narrative, that there's a sort of continuity of psyche, of the Irish psyche, that it, of course, you know, the people of Ireland are not like the mad warriors of the past, but they have something in common with them. And you see all through the Irish story, from the pagan origins through the early Christian period, right up to the present, a certain strain, a certain fierceness, coupled with humor, a willingness to jump off the cliff, almost, of life, that perdures right through the whole history.
And you're one of those guests, I could talk to you for hours about this book, but we've been talking now for a while, so I think we probably need to try to wrap this up.
That's fine.
I did a little research, and I hope you don't mind talking about this, but I understand that last night you gave a talk, and you've been giving a series of talks in New York about spiritual matters. Do you mind talking about that?
No, I don't at all mind talking about it. I never thought I would do something like that. It's very different from talking about a historical moment. I think of myself as a historian and somebody who likes to delve into the past and try to figure out what the past was really like and what people were really like in the past. But while doing this book, I actually spent some time in Rome, and there I came to be friends with a Roman community, which was founded by high school students in 1968, which was the great year of the student uprisings, not just here, but in Western Europe. And what these students decided to do was to... They wanted to be revolutionary also, but the way they decided to be revolutionary was they took over a church, which was empty, and decided that they would try to live as the early Christians had lived. And they would meet each evening and pray together, and the prayers were original. It was of their own composition. It was a very sort of spontaneous event. And they would read from the Gospels, and they would talk about the Gospel. And today, almost 30 years later, there are about 8,000 members of this community across Italy and about 8,000 beyond Italy. The Roman community, which is still the sort of mother house or central community, which still has this church, the Church of Sant'Egidio or St. Giles. It's the community of St. Giles or Sant'Egidio in Italian. They actually serve 1,500 people dinner every night, and they don't do it on a soup line. They do it with true Italian generosity. They mm-hmm. sit them down to dinner, and they serve them. They also give out 1,500 quite substantial bags of groceries each week. They have an AIDS hospice. They have a shelter for abused and abandoned children. They have a place for old people whom no one else wants. They are practically the only voice speaking up in favor of the gypsies mm-hmm. in Italy today. And a few years ago, in addition to all of this, they decided that the gospel was impelling them to get involved in peace efforts. And they actually made peace in Mozambique this is a completely amateur effort. They made peace in Mozambique between the government and the guerrillas, and the peace has held. And they're now attempting a similar outreach in Algeria and in the Balkans. Mm. Every year they hold a meeting in one of the beautiful cities of Europe. Last year it was in Florence, and I went to it for the first time. And it's called Uomini e Religioni, Human Beings and Religion, or People and Religion, Religions, plural. They invite leaders from every religion on earth to come and pray together for several days and talk with one another. Now, I actually saw during this meeting Serbs and Bosnians sitting down and talking to one another, and Israelis and Arabs, and even Irish Protestants and Irish Catholics talking to one another. This is the one that was in Florence was the ninth one. The tenth one will be held in Assisi in September of this year. And this is that what they're gradually doing is they're creating a network of people all over the world whose common understanding is that religion should bring peace rather than war, whatever religion it might be. And I think over a period of time, this network will really make a difference in many little corners and maybe not so little corners. And anyway, they were my inspiration to start this series at St. Malachy's in New York and to invite people as a result of the series, as a result of their coming to the series, to form a prayer group, which we have done, and begin to talk about what the gospel might impel us to do. Of course, Patrick is connected to all of this in some way. Mm-hmm. This is not completely without connection to Patrick. I don't mean to connect it so much with my book, but I really did feel that in reading Patrick, I had discovered somebody I had never known was there, and that there was this great, great, wonderful human being who was quite unlike any of the plaster of Paris depictions of him, was a real person who just sprang right off the page and who made an enormous difference in his own time, and a difference so large that it's hard even to talk about it easily in words, because as we said earlier, our lives would be so different if it had not been for this one single funny little guy. And so I am interested in the way in which individual, ordinary human beings can make a difference.
On that note, Tom Cahill has been my guest, and his new book, which just came out in the paperback version, How the Irish Saved Civilization, The Untold Story of Ireland's Heroic Fall from...
Roll.
I keep saying that.
They fell many times. They only had a roll once.
The Untold Story of Ireland's Heroic Roll from the Fall of Rome to the Rise of Medieval Europe. Truly an engaging book. I recommend it, folks. I really enjoyed having you come by.
Thank you, Vic. I really enjoyed being here.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 1996 interview with Thomas Cahill for his book, How the Irish Saved Civilization, The Untold Story of Ireland's Heroic Role, From the Fall of Rome to the Rise of Medieval Europe. That was the first book in his Hinges of History series, and it is now up to 6 books, and there will be one more book, which he is apparently working on right now. He's 77 years old, and I'll keep watching for that one. And I mentioned earlier that we had dinner together after his book signing that night in 1996, and he was waiting for his ride back to his hotel at Dayton, and he was waiting for the car service, the limousine, to pick him up, and it never showed up. And fortunately, there was another patron at the bar who had perhaps had a few too many glasses of wine, but he very generously offered to drive Tom Cahill back to his hotel, and Tom got into his pickup truck. And I guess they had quite an adventurous ride back to Dayton. Thomas Cahill, remembering one of my favorite interviews from the Best of the Book Nook, recorded back in 1996. And I hope you all have a happy St. Patrick's Day when it comes up this month. And if you want to know more about Ireland, that is the book for you. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.